join the Betamax Video Club, rewinding back to our favourite films of the 1980s. My name's Rich Nelson, and today I've rented Back to the Future. Watching with me is the cartoonist Andy Fanton. Hi Andy, how are you?
Hi, I'm good, thanks. How are you?
I'm very good, and thank you for bringing this copy, we'll call it a Betamax copy of Back to the Future. Now, as is always the way, I've been awful at getting back in touch with people. We talked about doing this donkeys ago. We could almost go back in time and start it then. What's so special about Back to the Future for you?
Well, as far as I can recall, it was the first film that I saw that was rented from a video shop. My auntie took it out one evening, and we went round their house and we were watching it, so it's got kind of a sentimental thing there. But beyond that, I think the film in general is just, I don't know, it just stands up so well. Even going back to it, you know, you go back to some things from your youth and they don't hold up quite so well, but Back to the Future just continually, I can watch it again and again and again and not be bored or not be disappointed or anything, you know. And the fact that it's been, the trilogy as a whole has been left alone all these years, and they haven't gone back to reboot it, remake it, add a trillion sequels or anything, you know, it's been, you know, they've done the story, it's there and it's held up. Yeah,
well, I'll go with you on the sentimental side, because I remember this was the first video that we, or the first videotape that we owned,
and
I say completely off brand spit, it was a VHS, but I remember my dad bringing it home, and I was a little bit, I can't remember how old I would have been, sort of 6 or 7, thinking, what's this? I'd never really heard of it or seen anything, and being completely blown away. I mean, I went to see the second and the third films at the cinema, and this was like the screen of the green in Islington, so it always has nice memories around that time. And again, just that they kind of sit there so nicely in that part of my brain. And I think, like you touched on there, the fact that they've made a point of saying there won't be any sequels, there won't be remakes, there won't be reboots, it leaves it so nicely bookended that I think anything, maybe it wouldn't spoil it, but it would certainly dilute, I think, a lot of, I mean, when you look at what they did with Indiana Jones, for example, it's probably the best comparison.
Yeah, best not to go back to some to some things, but I mean, obviously they've done bits and pieces like the cartoon, and they're doing a musical now, aren't they? But the movie trilogy as a whole, they've left so perfectly alone that it's nice. Yeah, it doesn't dilute it, as you say.
Well, I think and going back and watching it again last night, and it was the first time I'd sort of purposefully sat down and watched it for quite a while, because it's always, you kind of flick through, and I think maybe it's just my channel surfing habits, I don't know, but I always seem to stumble across the second or the third one
on like
halfway through, and the first one, you don't see it on TV quite as often, or if it is, it's more of a kind of an obvious showing. But I remember going to see it, because I think they re-released it on DVD or Blu-ray for its 25th anniversary, so that would have been, blimey, 10 years ago. And I went to see it at the cinema, and it was the first and only time I've seen the first one at the cinema. And you still come away just thinking, wow.
I did the same, actually. Yeah, I did the same for the 25th. Yeah, went and saw it at the cinema. But yeah, you do come away going, blimey.
I mean, the special effects hold up. So, I mean, there aren't a huge amount. I mean, a lot of it, you know, this isn't a hugely effects-driven film, but even something like that, that can look a little bit rusty when you come back so many years later, it's still looking pretty damn good.
Yeah, I was thinking that, because I rewatched it as well, obviously, for this. And, like the general DeLorean effect of it going back in time and stuff like that still looks really nice. There's a couple of dodgy ones as you get, you know, the bit where he's looking at his hand as it's disappearing from... that's a bit, you can see the join. But generally, the effects, the DeLorean effect in particular, still looks really nice, and it's really kind of iconic.
I mean, I like the fact that, I mean, I have seen sporadically DeLoreans in my lifetime, and I've seen a couple of normal ones, and I've seen a couple that have been kitted out to look like the Back to the Future car, and it always looks very strange when you're seeing a driving through sort of Wimbledon and you're seeing a DeLorean with a Mr. Fusion time circuits kit on the back. It's always sort of always chucks you out of your kilter slightly. But even recently I saw that, I think, is it Playmobil are doing an advent calendar around the DeLorean and the sort of whole clock tower sequence, and you think, you know, 35 years later, this stuff's still getting made and presumably still selling quite well.
Yeah, yeah, I thought so. Yeah, I remember Lego did one as well, didn't they? A DeLorean, not so long ago. That might have been for the 25th as well, or the 30th, which I definitely picked up.
All these anniversaries are coming around thick and fast, aren't they?
They are, yeah. It's so crazy to think, like, 35 years now since it came out.
Yeah.
Like, what?
And, I mean, the thing is as well, I mean, we're now, and I'm not going to step on the sequels, you know, if I ever get around to doing those, but, you know, the future that they went into in the second film is 5 years ago from now, because we were at the end of 2020, and we still don't have real hoverboards.
They should have gone back a bit further. They should have gone to, like, 2025 and given us a warning about this year.
Yes, I think, well, I mean, I did make a joke about that. They went to 2015 and it's all gone horribly wrong ever since. So I wonder if this was the timeline that they actually ruined. But
thanks a lot, Marty.
He's to blame for everything. Now, something I talked about on a previous episode when we looked at the Goonies was how this film was produced and very much under the sort of the presented by Steven Spielberg umbrella.
Mm.
And it's kind of hard to separate the fact that, you know, growing up, you kind of think this is, it's a Spielberg film in all but name. And even though it was directed by Robert Zemeckis, this still has so many Spielberg elements to it. His fingerprints are all over it.
Oh, yeah, definitely.
It's definitely still got that magic.
Yeah. It's got all that kind of, it's all the kind of the wonderful and the weird mixed in with the mundane. You know, it takes place in quite a mundane kind of setting and then goes off into crazy directions, and that's definitely a Spielberg kind of signature. You can see it all over it.
And again, I mean, I suppose we're grateful he hasn't gone back and messed around with these ones like he did with some of his previous efforts, but I mean, I'm just sort of thinking about how, you know, this is set in a small California sort of town, or I suppose a town, not a city, or a hamlet or a village or anything like that. But, you know, the way when watching this, and I didn't realize until very recently that certainly the set that they use for Hill Valley, the town, is the same as they use in Gremlins.
Oh, is it?
Right. Well, apparently, yeah. I mean, it's only when I saw, I don't know if someone put it on social media or I read an article about it, but they put the picture side by side. And you kind of think, oh my God, they do, of course they've used the same set. And I suppose back then you need to think about saving a few dollars here and there, especially when apparently when they'd filmed so much of this. And again, this is something I think is becoming, it's not a little known fact anymore because everyone seems to know the fact that this was originally featuring Eric Stoltz as Marty McFly, and they ended up filming for weeks and then sacked him. And I think they spent millions of dollars on recasting and refilming.
That would have been weird.
It would have been, and when you see the photographs that do the rounds every so often of Stoltz in the scenes that you always associate Michael J. Fox, it really kind of, again, you know, and using Back to the Future thing, it is like an alternate timeline where imagine that had been the case.
The Eric Stoltz version.
I mean, I don't know, I think maybe it's just my thing or maybe it's his career. I haven't seen Eric Stoltz in an awful lot of things other than his role in Pulp Fiction, and that's probably it, to be honest.
That
would have been a weird film, wouldn't it?
I
did also read that sort of during the making, and they kept some of the bits in and go through a little bit of that, but Christopher Lloyd actually thought his name was Marty because he was pretending to be a method actor on the set and would only answer to Marty, and that must be very weird, because when they said I mean, one of the quotes I saw was when he said that Eric had been sacked and he said, "Who's Eric? I thought his name was Marty." So
typical Lloyd. One of the other things that it was originally going to be was it was going to be a time traveling fridge, wasn't it? That was something I read in about an early draft of the scripts, that it was going to have a time traveling fridge in it, but then they went with the car instead.
I did see the fridge, and they kind of think that's I think a lucky escape for us, although
definitely
you do wonder what sort of fridge it would have been and whether we'd now be getting Playmobil fridges and Lego fridges.
Obviously, Spielberg put that idea away for Indiana Jones and the Crystal Skull. Oh, a fridge as a method of transport. That'd be good.
He obviously had that on his bucket list somewhere. I want people's travelling fridges.
It's got to be done. No one's put a fridge as a transport in a film before.
He obviously didn't see
that. I'll be the one.
Those public information videos about being careful about getting locked in a chest freezer or something like that.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. I can get away with it. Writing for kids' comics, I'm not allowed to put kids in fridges. So.
Speaking of which, have you ever kind of done anything? Because, I mean, you do a lot for the Beano and the Viz. Have you ever done a lot of... Is there any Back to the Future-inspired work or drawings that you've done?
Probably. I mean, for the Beano, the 4,000th Beano, there was... We did a whole time travel story where there was a future Dennis who came back to warn everyone that Beano Town in the year, I can't remember what it was, oh, the year 4000, that's, yeah, was had been overtaken by an evil mayor, and he had banned laughter and banned the Beano as a consequence, as a source of laughter, because they had managed to harness laughter as a renewable fuel source kind of thing, a clean energy source, and he wanted to go back to petrol and all that kind of thing, so... yeah, so there was and then they had to go into the future and try to stop that from happening, and you know, so yeah, there's definitely been some time travel inspired stories and Back to the Future inspired.
Oh, super! I suppose one of those that permeates pop culture and everything else always seems to pop up everywhere.
Yeah, 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 definitely. Just look at Rick and Morty and stuff.
Yeah. Now, one thing I kind of always remember was, and it's easy when you go online and people sharing GIFs of stuff and everything, but the scene at the beginning when Marty goes into Doc Brown's house, and I guess we can always be revisionist and look at it with 2020 eyes rather than 1985, and I always kind of wonder about the relationship between Doc and Marty, where... Marty pretty much has free reign of his house when he's not there.
Yeah.
You know, Marty's a 17-year-old kid, and Doc Brown must be, I suppose, in 85, he would have been, what, at least 60-plus.
Yeah, something like that, yeah.
Yeah, might not be the sort of thing you get away with today.
No, it's a strange relationship. They never really... I mean, to its credit, they never go back to the origins of it or anything, or try to explain it away. They're just, you know, two friends. It's kind of a... I guess I've always assumed in my head canon, that they've just been drawn together because they're both kind of dreamers, and they're both kind of a bit isolated from everyone else kind of thing, in a way. In a way, you know, like Marty's got his big dreams about being a musician, and Doc Brown's constantly thinking about inventions and coming up with his next big invention and stuff like that. And I don't know if that's what drew them together.
Well, I think, you know, we see that from the beginning when Marty goes into his house or whatever and plugs into this enormous amplifier that plays one note and sends him flying.
Yeah, yeah. That beginning scene, though, that's something I made a note of last night, was that whole bit from the first scenes of the clocks, and it's all silent until Marty walks in kind of thing. I was just thinking about how good a bit of world building and character building it is in a few minutes, done pretty much silently, because you get the pan across the clock, so you get the theme of the time. You see some inventions like the dog food feeder and stuff like that, so you get the idea that there's a wacky inventor who lives here. Then obviously Marty walks in and he puts the key under the mat, so you know he's acquainted with a scientist. I was thinking that's quite impressive, really.
Yeah, and again, like watching it now, I mean, it's always different to watch a film with a pen and paper to hand, and you're kind of noticing more about, like you say, that the things in the background. I mean, there's the photographs and the newspaper clippings on the wall.
Yeah.
And then you've got that little bit of exposition where the news coverage comes on just as they're talking about the plutonium, which Marty then rolls his skateboard into.
And I noticed amongst the clocks as well, I don't know if it's intentional, it must be intentional, but that Harold Lloyd clock of, there's a Harold Lloyd clock with Harold Lloyd hanging off the clock hands of a clock. And I was thinking, oh, that's got to be a call forward to when Doc Brown does the same on the clock tower later, surely.
Yeah. And then you were kind of, and again, without trying to go too sort of cross-eyed or thinking too much about this stuff, by the time we get to this 1985, that will have been in the past. So that would have already happened. Yeah. And it's just this whole thing. We can go down rabbit holes of what came first and everything like this. But I mean, the whole setup from that, it is just, you know, like you say, it's simple. It leads you in very gently. This isn't an all impact kind of scene. And immediately, because the alarms all go off at the same time while Doc's on the... It's this random experiment that the alarms are all 25 minutes too slow. You kind of realise, like, I mean, for a scientist of some regard, I don't know. I mean, synchronizing clocks must just be something he does just to sort of keep his mind sharp or something. If he's invented yeah. if he's invented a time machine and he's also setting clocks off to go off 25 minutes late, then it's an odd experiment to have. But it shows like Marty. You know, I mean, whether this demonstrates something about him that he's late for school again, and we have the iconic Huey Lewis and the News music as he skateboards into Hill Valley, which always looks really cool. But I think if you see kids, or and you always shake your fist at a cloud and say kids today dangling off the back of cars on skateboards, you kind of think that the world's gone to pot.
Yeah.
Would that be something Dennis the Menace or one of the Bash Street Kids might do?
Well, hang on a second. Well, I don't know if I'd get away with it nowadays. Yeah, you probably would. They're all mad skateboarders at some point, it seems. They're all quite prolific on a skateboard or a go-kart, it seems.
As he gets to school, we're introduced to his girlfriend, Jennifer. And I'm not going to, again, yes, she was a different Jennifer in the next film. I know that. I always get tweets if I don't mention this stuff. I had a massive crush on this Jennifer.
Yeah, Claudia Wells.
Yeah. Oh, glorious.
I would think I was more of a Shoe man.
Yeah, I mean, I preferred Shoe in other stuff. Shoe, like I'm talking about her like she's a footballer. But in other things, but I think of the Jennifers, it was definitely Claudia Wells. And and we're also introduced to Strickland. I think this is James Tolkien's probably third appearance on a podcast. And one thing we noted when we talked about it on Top Gun, because when he went head to head with Tom Cruise, you kind of wonder how tall must he be, because he's eye to eye with Michael J. Fox as well, who's not exactly a tall man himself.
No, you could get it was a thing of the 80s, wasn't it? You could get away with quite diminutive leading men. They all seem to be like Herculean kind of whatever.
I think my dog's taking exception to that somehow. Yeah, and you kind of think like they didn't make him stand on a box or anything else. It was all very eye to eye. And I mean, if Michael J. Fox is 5'4", yeah, James Tolkien must be. Yeah, he must be about the same.
Yeah, yeah.
You're a slacker.
So we have Marty, and as you said already, he's this aspiring rock musician, and he is auditioning for this sort of dance school dance they're having, and he's what's the band's name? The Pinheads.
The Pinheads, yeah, that's right.
And it must be strange. I mean, you've got the teacher is Huey Lewis, and the Pinheads are playing a altered version of a Huey Lewis song. So
just
nice little
loud.
Touch there. I wonder how many times Huey Lewis has said that. This is another appearance for him after. We did an episode about American Psycho quite recently, and I remember him.
Oh,
Now, this is another sort of exposition part heavy when Jennifer and Marty go outside. There's the van saying re-elect Mayor Goldie Wilson, just to let you know that's the current mayor. You get the woman shaking the tin for the clock tower, and we hear the whole story about that. And so it all becomes quite important at the end.
Yeah, it's not particularly subtle, but it's you also get Marty eyeing up another couple of girls' backsides while he's walking with Jennifer as well, which I've always thought, what's that all about, Marty? What's your problem?
Yeah, he's got quite
with Claudia Wells.
He's not exactly subtle, is he?
No, he's not. But yeah, you get the same the clock tower stuff, and you get a lot of the kind of the George McFly quotes that will feature quite heavily, that if you put your mind to it, you can accomplish anything. And what if they say they don't like it? I don't think I'm ready for that kind of rejection. Those kind of things that cycle through the film with his dad.
Yeah, everything's a bit of a... It's kind of... Everything's being put there to come back to later on. You know, there's not much wasted dialogue here.
No, definitely not. No, there's not a second wasted, really, no.
No.
And yeah, he's at the truck as well, which obviously comes back at the end as well.
Of course. Everything's there for a reason.
Everything's there for a reason.
Yeah. And by the time they get home, Marty finds that the car, because he was planning a weekend away with Jennifer, the car's been written off by Biff, And I mean, some of the things that Biff says, and again, judging it by sort of different standards and different, being in the UK, for example, and he's talking about, well, why should I pay for this with my insurance? It's your car. And who's going to get, I spilt beer when it crashed into me. And it's kind of with modern eyes, the kind of thing is, so he's admitting to drunk driving, essentially driving without insurance, if he's going to insist that someone else, you know, there's probably an offence under the Road Traffic Act and probably perjury there as well, if you're thinking about it. And this is all part of this sort of something that we'll explore, this 30 plus year relationship between Biff and George, where Biff is the high school bully who's turned into pretty much a bully over the course of his whole life, and George refusing to stand up to him. It's it's weird.
Yeah, it's kind of like the central thrust of the film in many ways, isn't it? Because it's what plays into the whole drama going forward, and obviously it's George's character arc that then changes the future when Marty comes back to it, or changes the present when Marty comes back to it, from the past into the future.
Oh no, I've gone cross-eyed.
Yeah, it's easily done. It's easily done with this film. And you get this whole, again, everything's being set up where we have them, the family are having dinner, and Lorraine, Marty's mum, talks about, you know, and it's a conversation between her and her daughter about, you know, how am I meant to meet anyone? And it's kind of this that where it goes into how the whole story about how George was hit by her dad's car. She fell in love with him after this, and you know, just so it's there in our head so that later you know, we know exactly what should have happened. And it's weird, you know, that they have this life, you know, that George and Lorraine are presumably in their late 40s now and looking very, you know, Lorraine's drinking vodka at dinner, and it's their life doesn't seem particularly happy or fulfilling, but then maybe when you get to that age it probably isn't.
George is quite distracted as well, as he's busy watching his telly and he's trying to do Biff's work for him at the table, kind of thing. And yeah, it's not a very, and there's definitely kind of tinges of regret in Lorraine's, you know, speech when she looks at him and he starts laughing and she sort of looks a bit forlorn, like she's made a bad choice.
Yes.
And we get Jailbird Joey as well, of course. That'll come back in a bit. Yeah.
I suppose, like a lot of family dinners, when you're waiting for the outcome of a parole hearing for your uncle, it's What we'd had already was Marty took a phone call earlier. Now he goes to the local shopping mall, Twin Pines Mall. Let's make that quite apparent for later reference.
Twin.
Twin. There are two pines. And he goes there to assist Doc Brown with this latest experiment he's got. And as soon as he gets there, he sees Einstein the dog and this very showbiz entrance of the DeLorean.
Such a good entrance.
Dry ice everywhere and lights. It's all really flashy. And immediately you think, this isn't a clock-setting experiment. This is something that's quite important.
Yeah, I just like to imagine Doc sat there waiting for Marty to get there, going, any minute now, this is going to be great. Get ready. Come on, Marty. Yeah, now.
And when he rolls the car, and when he gets out of the car, after it's come down the little ramp, and he gets out, and the car itself is full of dry ice. So he's been sitting in there getting gassed. No wonder he looks so frazzled.
All for the sake of a showbiz entrance. And immediately, right away, when Doc Brown steps out of the car, you get Christopher Lloyd doing his eye work. There's so much good Christopher Lloyd eyeball work in this movie. And as soon as he steps out, it looks a bit like, whoa, what's happened?
There's a lot of, explaining about the car and the fact that he has it on a remote control, and he's showing that this car, you know, isn't just a flashy car. And I mean, this is something I'll explore a little bit later on, but I mean, these cars are famously quite, I wouldn't say reliable, and the film later on shows that they're not particularly reliable, and yet everyone hears DeLorean and thinks of Back to the Future. It kind of, the car became famous or infamous because of this film, and yet it's beset by mechanical problems.
Yeah, it's going to show what a bit of a good PR can do for you.
And he manages to send Einstein forward into the future, and there's this sort of very interesting, you know, explanation that he's got the lorry empowered by remote control, and saying when the car hits 88 miles an hour.
My calculations are correct. When this baby hits 88 miles per hour, you're going to see some serious shit.
And he's very brave to involve Marty in the demonstration of the time machine, because he gets Einstein in the car to drive straight at them.
Yeah. And Marty tries to back off, and Christopher Lloyd does that more great eyeball work, sort of looking at him, telling him to get back next to him kind of thing. Mike's thinking, oh, this looks a bit dangerous, and he's, no, come back here. Yeah. We're doing this together.
If this goes wrong, we're all going out in a blaze of glory.
Yeah.
And eventually there's also a near miss, should we put it, in health and safety context, when Einstein returns or arrives, and the car, they just happen to be standing where the car's going to come out again. When he explains the car, I mean, the joke around the time circuits, and he's talking about being there at the birth of Christ and the Declaration of Independence. And he has, and again, I think I've said this many times, I'm no scientist, but if you're in Hill Valley, California on December 25th, 000, you're going to struggle
you're not going to have particularly good seats for the for the birth, no.
Yeah.
And it seems as a scientist as well, he seems, I don't know, it seems almost... like, would he be actually believing that would be a thing that would happen? I don't, you know, I don't know. Maybe he's a religious scientist. I don't know.
Possibly. And so maybe it'd be obvious. You'd see the star in the sky or something. I don't know.
Oh yeah, maybe. Yeah.
And he decides to put in, you know, a significant date for him of November 5th, 1955, and then again, a little bit of nice helpful explanation explains why that's important. Yeah. It's the day he invented time travel.
By slipping off a toilet.
Yeah, it's funny. Last time I fell off a toilet was after a few too many beers, and I certainly didn't invent anything other than probably some new swear words. But something that's another callback is when he says he wants to go into the future. Oh, sorry. I forgot the main bit of this was because this is all being videoed on camcorder. He explains that he needs to generate.
I need a nuclear reaction to generate the 1.21 gigawatts of electricity.
What did I just say?
The flux capacitor stores... This sucker's electrical. But I need a nuclear reaction to generate the 1.21 gigawatts of electricity.
1.21 gigawatts!
1.21 gigawatts, yeah.
Which, of course, comes in handy later on, but... because you can't imagine a 17-year-old Michael J. Fox retaining all this information. but Doc says he wants to go forward in time and see the results of the next 25 World Series, as though it's like, is he going to put a bet on or something? But, you know, enough of that.
That's a story for another day, another year.
And luckily, the Libyans that he'd explained he stole the plutonium from just so happened to have tracked him down to this shopping centre on a Saturday morning at 1 a.m. chasing them around. There's a lot of swearing in this, which for if I remember it being a PG, there's a lot of shit and bastard and all that stuff.
Yeah, I think that was quite indicative of a lot of PG films that I grew up with, certainly. Like Ghostbusters has got a fair share of swears in it as well. Different times, I guess. Get away with it. Cussing in front of the kids.
Yeah, better times, some will say, but not me.
Those Libyans as well, they're one of the things that, I don't know, hold up so well nowadays. I don't know, it seems like a kind of a holdover from the 80s, and then, like, it's something you'd see more in, like, Arnold Schwarzenegger or Stallone films of the time. Like, it was always Middle Eastern kind of bad guys all the time, you know what I mean? And then they crop up in this as well as to come and get their plutonium back off Doc Brown.
Yeah, they were kind of portrayed as just these sort of interchangeable... brown people. And I think at least sometimes, you know, I mean, whether it's good or bad, in some of those other action films, they kind of give them these fictional countries that they're from. And here it's like, no, they're Libyan.
Just Libyan. Here they are.
Just to make a point of it, yeah. and I, you know, he goes into, so I was going to build the Libyans a bomb. It's like, yeah.
Yeah, not very subtle.
No. And the Libyans shoot Doc Brown with a machine gun. Marty escapes in the DeLorean, and I guess hitting 88 miles an hour, he's, you know, obviously in fear of his life, being chased by Libyans in a in one of these sort of camper vans with a rocket launcher.
Yeah, VW camper. My dad used to have one when we grew up, so I always used to, you know, sort of be kind of excited to see one on the screen, although it was being driven by terrible terrorists, obviously.
Were you ever tempted to stand out the top and shoot a rocket launcher at a
vehicle? So many times, but I wasn't allowed.
If you're stuck in traffic, it's okay.
Yeah.
And immediately, because we know that the car, when it hits 88 miles per hour, if the time circuits are on, there's a flash as he's driving through the car park, and all of a sudden he's in this farm, and it's just so well done. I think the fact that it just changes instantaneously. You're with Marty now,
from his point of view, kind of thing. Yeah.
Yeah.
Because you see, it's obviously the flash, and then you see a scarecrow. You're like,
right in his face.
I like the little tease in the lineup in the lead up to that as well, when they're chasing around the car park and he's going around the corners, and so the speed dips slightly and you're sort of there going, oh, any minute now, you know. It's just a nice little oh no he's not, now he is.
It's a good job they also had the digital display on the dashboard as
yes,
well.
Definitely.
And as he gets into this alternate reality, we'll put it, for the time being, he crashes into a barn, because everyone has a barn in the 50s, and in his radiation suit, very handily, just to demonstrate the point that when the farmer and his kids come into the barn to see what's happening, the kid, and I guess I don't know what time of the day it was, they all go down to see, and the kid's holding a comic book with the front of it is Aliens from Outer Space, and there's a man in a yellow suit coming out of a spaceship that looks very much like a DeLorean.
It's a very specific comic book. Yeah, really convenient. Specific comic book for the situation. Yeah.
Is that what you're hoping one day for one of yours, to just one of these will come true?
One day one of these will come true, and it'll be referenced in Back to the Future 4, won't it?
It'd be the time travel from 4000, that they come back and say, oh my god, they're holding it's COVID.
Yeah, that's right. And that's Old Man Peabody as well, isn't it? Obviously
it is. Yeah, so we're on, and again, this is the point trying to raise earlier, you know, if you go back in time, you go back to where you were at that exact location.
Yeah,
so
spatial.
you don't go back to the birth of Christ, you go back to the fact that the Twin Pines was actually a farm where he was trying to breed pine trees. And as all farmers have shotguns, and as this farmer was trying to shoot the alien / Marty, he drives off, takes out a pine tree, which luckily, when we go back later on, become the because there's only one pine, the shopping centre is now Lone Pine Mall.
Yeah. And it's accompanied by the great line, "You space bastard, you killed my pine."
I really should try and use that one more often.
I'll try and sneak it into a Beano or something.
This is something that I guess you probably would do for comfort. You're not really sure what's happening. You're in a car, you go home. Marty drives back to his house, or where his house is, and it's still being built. You've just got the front entrance to this estate.
The Lyons estate, yeah.
Yeah.
I'm always confused slightly by the time, what happens, time, because when he's in the Peabody's farm, it's like, / Twin Pines Mall, it's nighttime. But when he rolls up to Lyons estate, it's daytime. And I'm thinking, how long is the journey? Because it didn't seem to take him that long to get down there to see Doc in the first place. But coming back, it seems to have taken substantially more time.
Yeah,
confused.
I'm sure someone will have done a timeline of this, because I guess because again, the DeLorean has problems. He has to park the DeLorean and then walk, and the amusing scene of trying to hitchhike. But he walks into Hill Valley, and then it's fully daytime. And
it says it's 2 miles away.
Yeah, there must be a clock or something that someone's looked at and seen, right, well, from the time circuits, he arrived at this time, and then he's landed in Hill Valley. And assuming this is a, I think it's a Sunday morning,
he arrives
in Hill Valley, and whatever time it is, there's a lot of people milling around, and this is something that you probably associate with the 50s. All the men are in suits and hats, and
lots of women. Hats.
Yeah, and you kind of think, well, are they on their way to church or on their way back, or is this just how people hang out in the 50s?
Yeah, just milling around with your hats, having a nice day. But yeah, you get to see the 50s Hill Valley and all the slight changes from, like, the cinema. Like, in the 80s, it's showing like, porn, isn't it, or something?
I can't remember.
It's showing, like, American Orgy or something. Isn't that what it's called?
I think so.
And then here it's showing a Ronald Reagan film, I think, isn't it?
To feed
into a joke later. Don't know which is worse, a porn or a... Ronald Reagan film.
different strokes.
Yeah.
And I think in the 80s as well, there was one I saw in the background, like a nudie magazine shop in the background, which is now, I think, a stationery in the 50s, stationery shop. And again, just to show that things are very different, the clock tower works because it strikes and goes off.
Yeah, I really like that moment when you hear the strike of it, and it might sort of... Even mine's taken aback a bit because it hasn't worked at all in his lifetime, I guess. So he's like, the clock's working. Blimey.
So like you would do in that situation, you go into the local cafe and use the phone, and we start to see the differences in what he's used to, because he's got a digital watch that beeps when he's in the phone booth. He's asking he's asking for things. And there's that, you know, we talked about before around the whole... call it fish out of water thing, but he's very out of his comfort zone. He asks for a tab, which at the time of writing have finally been discontinued.
Have they?
Apparently, yeah. I mean, I only remember in this country for a very brief period in the sort of early to mid 90s. But
I remember being a kid, being quite confused by that exchange, because I didn't know what tab or Pepsi Free were at the time. I was like, what are they talking about?
Well, exactly.
Oh, it's their drinks. Okay.
Yeah. Because I mean, I remember having tab here, and it's basically.
Yeah, I do remember it, but I think it was after I'd first seen this.
Oh, yeah. I'd have probably been 11 or 12 when it came out here.
Yeah. And he tears a page out of the phone book as well.
Little vandal.
You don't just go into someone's cafe and tear out a page of the phone book and wave it in the owner's face.
He's clearly a rebel. And in the cafe, he sits down, and all of a sudden he starts. You look at the mannerisms he does. He puts his hand behind his neck, and it's exactly the same as the person next to him, who we find out when someone comes in and shouts McFly. Turn around.
Yes, and it's old Biff and his gang with Billy Zane in it.
Billy Zane. God.
Billy Zane.
I didn't really acknowledge him at all until I think Titanic came out. And he suddenly became this kind of... I mean, he had a weird cameo in Zoolander and things like that, but he'll always be Biff's goon.
He is. That's his finest work, Biff's goon. He popped up in The Boys as well recently. I don't know if you've seen that on Amazon.
I haven't. Boys. No.
He's popped up in that a couple of times. He's like in Universe, I think he's an actor who's playing a superhero, you know, kind of thing. But he keeps popping up like just here and there in like mock commercials and conventions and stuff. It's quite funny. He's just there, but he's saying...
He was in Back to the Future.
It's
now.
Good.
I'll have to check that out. A few people have suggested it.
It's good. Yeah, it's very good. I'm still only working through season two, but I'm enjoying it.
Okay.
And it's got Elizabeth Shue in it to bring it back to the Future.
Oh, okay. I'll definitely have to watch it then.
There you go. Yeah. There's a link. Points. We aren't off topic at all.
Some people don't like the tangents, but there's always a reason.
It's all thought out.
Now, in this cafe, young Biff walks in, and again, we see immediately it's that sort of dynamic where he's the bully demanding that George does his homework for him.
It's just an echo of that earlier scene, isn't it? It's just the same kind of thing. You wouldn't want me to get into trouble, would you? That kind of thing, and tapping on the head.
Yeah, I mean, he's using pretty much the same language. And George disappears, and we hear again Goldie Wilson, the future mayor of Hill Valley, is working in this cafe as a busboy or something like that. Insert derogatory term used by cafe owner. And, you know, the fact that Goldie Wilson is black.
It's one of those things that keeps cropping up when people talk about this film. Is like, is Marty putting ideas in people's heads, or are the ideas already there before he puts them in kind of thing. Because he suggests to Goldie Wilson, yeah, he's going to be mayor. And that sort of was the first time the idea dawns upon Goldie. He's sort of like, yeah. And you're like, was he already thinking that? Or has Marty implanted that idea now going forward? You know, it's like, who's come up with the idea for Mayor Goldie Wilson?
Yeah, I think that must be it. I mean, I suppose Marty's kind of trying to put some familiarity into his universe.
Yeah.
You know, and again, he's getting his tenses right though, but he's going to be mayor as though that's... But then would he have been mayor already, or, you know...
Yeah, without Marty going there and... Yeah.
Where has that seed been planted?
Yeah. It's what Doctor Who would call wibbly-wobbly timey-wimey, isn't it?
He's a peeping Tom. Dad! Hey, wait a minute. Who are you? Stella! Another one of these damn kids jumped in front of my car!
Marty runs off, finds George up a tree bird watching, for argument's sake. Pair of binoculars looking at a woman in undressing into her underwear. And at this point, he falls out of the tree, which we know from Marty's mum is when he gets hit by her dad driving a car. But Marty pushes him out the way and gets hit by the car himself. So immediately there's that, you know, if we didn't have it already, there's that big butterfly effect moment.
I also like the line that her dad does when he's looking at Marty on the floor going, Stella, another one of those damn kids jumped in front of my car. Like, this is something that's happened before.
everyone hides out that tree.
Yeah. And he knocks them down.
So they've been busy looking at the woman in the window.
Yeah.
Marty wakes up, and again, this is something that recurs throughout the trilogy. He wakes up in the darkness. He's confused, normally because he's had a concussion of some sort. He thinks it's his mum there looking after him, which technically it is. And there's this whole the kind of shock is when you've woken up in 1955.
Yeah, you were safe and sound back in 1955. That's the
shock,
thing that recurs.
Yeah, shock, horror, the light goes on and it's his mum looking... like very much like mid-80s Leah Thompson, which is very good.
Yeah, very good. Yes. she's so thin.
That she is. And we get something that probably did wonders for Calvin Klein as well. She basically ensures that they'll always have a line of purple underwear to sell, mistakenly thinking his name is Calvin Klein because his name's on them.
Yeah.
We get a few other sort of bits in here where she takes him downstairs to meet technically his grandparents. They sit around the dinner table and they wheel out this TV and it's showing the same show that George was watching.
Yeah.
Of all the shows in all the world, you know, why this one?
What are the chances?
And when he's asking his granddad for directions and he says, oh, that's by John F. Kennedy Drive. Of course, we're at this point where... I think we're, what, 8 years, I think, was it 7 or 8 years before Kennedy was killed. But then I don't know if the dad would have realised who John F. Kennedy would have been at that point. I don't know.
No. Might
have
been. Yeah, it seems to be the implication, doesn't it? Who the hell was John F. Kennedy?
Yeah. He certainly wasn't president at that point anyway.
No.
And then going on to that, he does eventually go to Doc Brown's house and there's the contraption in his head where he's trying to read his mind and... you know, an introduction to a different Doc Brown. This is the Doc Brown of the 50s, where he doesn't look 30 years younger.
He's got a snazzy jacket on, though.
Oh, yes. It's quite shiny. looks like a sort of Saturday evening entertainer.
It does. And we've got the Brown Mansion as well, because one of the earlier plots is, well, not plots, but things that we see right at the start is that the Brown Mansion gets burnt in a... destroyed in a fire or something. It's one of the newspaper clippings in the very first thing, and he's living kind of like next to a Burger King in 1985. But here we see the Brown Mansion in all its glory with its little workshop adjacent to it, and so it's quite interesting to see it. Or I don't know where he gets his money from, though, because he doesn't seem to have invented anything of use yet.
Well, no, but I mean, at one point he says, I think when he was talking about inventing the time machine, he said he used his family sort of fortune.
So oh, that's right. Yeah.
So I guess maybe his family had been rich, or at least rich enough to own this mansion that he destroyed.
Van Brahms, as they're later. No, isn't that in Back to the Future 3? I think he says that we came here as the Van Brahms.
Yeah.
Yeah. So, and German, rich German parents.
Yeah, coming over there. I don't know.
Making time machines.
So, yeah, and this house, you know, which we now in 1985 has ceased to exist, but it's very much their sort of home in 55. And we do get that brilliant part where he's quizzing him about, you know, who's the president in 1985, and he says Ronald Reagan. I mean, it's just...
Who's vice president? Jerry Lewis. Yeah, you could think of that now. I was thinking that myself as well. Who's president of the United States? Donald Trump. The star of Home Alone 2?
Well, I suppose the equivalent would be, I mean, if we went back in time 30 years, it'd be 1990. And you think most Americans in 1990 would at least know who Donald Trump is. I mean, saying this, let's time this horribly. We're recording this on the election, the US election day in 2020.
Oh, of course we are, yeah.
So who knows what will happen in the next few weeks. But, you know, you go back in time. I mean, I suppose in 1990 he had the casinos and the resorts and everything else, and I suppose he'd have been if not a household name, then at least a lot of people would have known who he was. And not the future star of the Saint and Greavesy doing the Rumbelows Cup draw in 1992, or as you say, Home Alone 2, anything that he did. But,
or The Apprentice,
yeah. And you'd have probably got, if you'd said Donald Trump was the president, probably an even bigger overreaction from the Doc Brown equivalent.
The Doc Brown of 1990.
Who's vice president? Alan Sugar. So he manages to convince him that he knows about, because he explains the toilet, about the flux capacitor, which obviously shows that, you know, it's that kind of provenance that he knows that this is, you know, I am who I say I am. I know your stories. Yeah. And takes him to the car. And of course, it's like, it worked. I finally invent something that works. And this is him saying it in 1955. So he's obviously continuing to invent throughout his life.
Doing nothing that works.
Yeah. And luckily, because Marty had been videoing the whole experiment back in 1985, we knew exactly how to get them back to the future, because they didn't exactly have a lot of plutonium. The Libyans turned up just as they were putting the plutonium back in the car, and the 1.21 gigawatts, which is just a thing now, you know, that if you think of a measurement of electricity, you always think of 1.21
gigawatts. 21 gigawatts. I've always wondered how they hook up an 80s VCR with a 50s. I suppose Doc Brown knows how to do this kind of thing, but it always seemed like, would they be compatible? I don't know, would they, with a 50, old 50s TV?
Well, I was trying to think. I mean, did he invent a universal adapter or something like that? Or
maybe.
Yeah, I mean, I can't even remember what sort of fittings we had in 1985, but I mean, SCART was probably far too advanced for them.
Yeah, I thought so. Yeah, maybe it would have worked.
Just red, always... white, yellow cables.
I like when Doc Brown's watching the video as well. He's asking why he's wearing a radiation suit, and of course, it's the fallout from the atomic wars. Like, he's just where his mind's imagining the future's going to go.
Yeah, I suppose we're at that point where we're starting to come up to, again, this is more Kennedy time, but the Cuban Missile Crisis and everything.
Yeah, exactly, yeah.
The fears of living in the 1950s when it is nuclear war and everything else. When in actual fact, Doc Brown is living, as you said, next door to a Burger King. So.
Yeah.
And at this point, and again, everything is there for a reason. We've got Marty just happens to have the flyer about the clock tower on him, because it was,
and he's just using it to demonstrate that he's got a girlfriend, isn't he? It's not an idea or anything. He's just going, look, she wrote this for me, and waves the flyer at him. And it's like, oh, I need a bolt of lightning.
it's the old equivalent of saying my girlfriend goes to a different school. I have one, honest. And we get introduced to the concept of the photograph of his brother's head vanishing. And when he says about, have you interacted with anyone? And he said, well, I met my parents, and completely disrupted the whole way that they first met.
My man fancies me.
Yeah. I mean, there's a whole, and I think this is probably where this starts, is this whole kind of thing where if you talk about Back to the Future now, a lot of it goes, oh, incest. And that is a weird kind of subplot throughout. And of course, where Maybe this is becoming more apparent with people doing those DNA tests and you're suddenly realizing you're related to your wife or something like that. I don't know. but, you know, the fact that because Marty took his dad's place, his mum now fancies him. And, yeah. I mean, something I've always kind of wondered, because, and again, spoiler alert, when they go back to 1985, you know, they're still living in the same house. The parents are together. They've had the same kids, presumably at the same time. At what point did George query that they had a son who looked exactly like the kid who set them up?
Yeah, and had the same name.
Yeah, she said, oh, we must call him Marty after that guy. Remember the guy who looked exactly like him?
the guy who was called Marty, who looked exactly like him and brought us together.
Yeah.
Really, really good at guitar.
Jeremy Carr would have a field day with that, I think.
And
you're in that kind of situation now where, because they go, the whole point of the next, I suppose, 5 or 6 days until they know that this bolt of lightning is coming, the whole plot now goes back to Marty making sure that his dad and his mum get together, because otherwise he won't exist. Just to put that kind of paradox subplot in there, just to keep it going, and it works so well that, I guess, having not been a 17-year-old girl, I can't really put myself in that position, but if she has suddenly started fancying someone and the person that she fancies is trying to push someone else on her, that would probably take longer than a week to engineer.
Yeah, you would have thought so, yeah.
Especially when George is portrayed as this, I suppose, a dweeb. You know, he's getting kicked and bullied at school. He's very much into his... And this is something that hasn't aged quite as well, is that, you know, because he writes science fiction stories, he's kind of portrayed as a loner and a weirdo, whereas now that's probably quite quirky and he'd be very popular because he'd probably have his own, yeah. He'd probably have his own show on Netflix. But, you know, he's in that position, and Marty's job is to make George look, you know, attractive enough to Lorraine for her to fancy him. And without skipping over too much, I mean, you know, he has to get George into her as well. And the way they engineer it, and I'm sort of jumping ahead slightly, is they have to basically stage a sexual assault in order to make George step up to the plate. It's, again, maybe that was how things worked in the 50s, I don't know. But watching it now, it's kind of very, I say, awkward.
Yeah, very. It's quite a dark plan for such a light-hearted film, you know. It's like,
I mean, it's a dark plan, and it gets hijacked and becomes even darker because
Biff gets involved. Yeah, that's the point where Biff goes from being like the comedy bully, the comedy jock, to being a full-on abuser. It's like, whoa, it takes a turn.
Yeah, because we already know that from this scene in the school where Biff is trying to hit on Lorraine, so he's obviously got a crush on her as well. And some of his, you know, lines that he says, like, make like a tree and get out of here, you know, those kind of weird things that he gets sort of half wrong. And, you know, we know Biff is the villain, but he takes a turn further down the line that, as you say, goes beyond sort of high school bully.
Yeah, definitely, yeah. Hmm. Obviously, it's something that's exacerbated in the sequel as well.
Well, very
where
much,
where he could go.
Yeah, and that's back to Trump again. But and one thing that I think did the rounds quite recently, and unfortunately, like, we're recording this a few weeks after Eddie Van Halen died. As part of Marty's plan to get George to pursue Lorraine, I think is probably a medium way of putting it, he plays Van Halen music through his headphones because he's got this portable audio device as well. He just happens to carry his Walkman around with him, and pretends to be Darth Vader from Vulcan, just to kind of mix those references up nicely
to infuriate the both halves.
That's the thing. I think you need to do on, is it Star Wars Day, is do the old live long and prosper sign, and you piss half the people off, don't you?
Marty was doing it way before it was cool.
Yeah, and so he's got George on side by originally saying he'll melt his brain, which I suppose, again, to a 17-year-old in the 50s, this all seems very real. I mean, he's lucky he didn't go into some sort of delayed shock or anything else. Like, the next day he wakes up just a bit like, oh, I need to go speak to Lorraine because he said he'd melt my brain. This is the sort of thing that would cause severe psychological damage in some people.
And another thing we've got is another convenient, I don't think it's a comic book, I think it's like a pulp magazine, isn't it, by George's Head on the Pillow, that has a figure that's kind of similar enough to Marty's get up to be to inspire that idea in George. It's a lot of convenient covers in this book thing.
Yeah, he's wearing he's wearing the yellow radiation suit and everything. And again, you know, at the end of the film, you know, when George, spoiler, he's got a book because his sci-fi work has been published, and it's about two people who've been brought together, yeah, and almost by this Darth Vader in a yellow costume. I mean, it's,
yeah,
borrowing heavily from his previous influences.
Yeah, showing it shows that George does remember stuff. It's just they don't seem to remember Marty as Marty.
I wonder at some point when he's gone through the whole time travel process, has, you know, everything else has stayed as he's left it, but the memory of him has gone.
Yeah, maybe. Who knows?
There's a whole... This is like... This is becoming like... I haven't done an episode about the Terminator yet, but it's kind of like Who Came First. It's a whole chicken, yeah, and egg scenario, isn't it? But
it is, yeah.
This is the whole set piece around the cafe where George goes to speak to Lorraine. And one bit I always loved, and I think, what, you know, I'm 40 now, and you kind of think one day I'll still do it, where I'll go into a cafe and he says, Lou, milk, chocolate, slides it along. There must be outtakes of that.
Yeah, you would have thought so. Yeah, I've always wanted to do that as well. Just go into the cafe and order a chocolate milkshake like that and look so cool.
I think these days it would be more like walk into a pub and demand a pint, and the pint will go flying and start a riot as well. But
yeah, start a fight.
Yeah, I mean, this is a weird thing. Again, there's the cultural thing around this cafe being the kind of hub for the young people, because I guess this must be a weekday afternoon or evening or something like that, where everyone is in this cafe, the music's playing, yeah, everyone's chatting, and we get something that we'll come back to in one of the sequels, where it's like a saloon where Biff walks in and everything goes silent.
Yeah. And then Marty trips him up.
And that whole distracting punch thing, which I guess in 1955, maybe it hadn't been invented. Maybe this was where it first started.
yeah.
And then we'll see again further down the line that, yes, it suddenly become old hat because Biff or whoever it is becomes aware of it. But that was something I did read in my extensive IMDb research, that the punch was actually Eric Stoltz in the film. They didn't reshoot that bit. The bit where Biff actually gets hit in the face, that was Eric Stoltz's hand. Yeah.
Oh, blimey.
So I wonder if he gets royalties for that.
Hand over fist. Yeah, and another thing I like that recurs through all the films is the shot from behind Biff as he straightens up, you know, and you just see Marty's eyes over his shoulder sort of widening, like, whoa, look at the size of this guy, kind of thing. That keeps coming up as a motif throughout all three films as well, and I like it always makes me laugh.
I suppose it is that thing where it is the little guy against the big bully.
Yeah.
You know, because, I mean, they don't mention it really in the first film, but... you know, in the sequels, and this, he's got this whole thing about being called a chicken.
Oh, yeah.
And despite being 5 foot four or five, whatever he is, he has this thing where he'll stand up to anyone who calls him a chicken. In this case, he doesn't need to. But, you know, when you see Biff, who's probably 6 foot plus, towering over him, there is that kind of, oh, dear, what have I done? Before he kind of recomposes himself.
Yeah, he goes, oh, well, I'm in now. Might as well follow it through.
Yeah.
We also get George earlier. Just another thing of good George McFly moment is, I am your density. Obviously, I like that. Just reading up the line.
That's probably a more common chat-up line. I am your density. Yeah. I suppose if you're in the Big Bang Theory or if you're into science or that sort of thing, maybe that would work quite well.
Yeah.
This is the famous sequence then, because... Marty gets chased out of the cafe after punching Biff and is knocking his goons and Billy Zane over. He runs out, he steals the kid's sort of fruit box type scooter thing.
I love the other kid. I love the other kid who tries to stop him. There's a kid with like an orange hat on, and he just really commits to sort of going, nah! Throwing his hands down onto it. Every time I just watch that kid's performance, it's good.
And this, again, these kids and explored again in future films, you know, these recurring motifs. And he snaps it off, turns it into a skateboard that we know he's quite proficient at. And this chase around the town square, which, let's be honest, isn't a big town square, but
no.
You know, when I suppose when you cut across it and go through walkways and stuff, it becomes it. But you know, we show he's quite proficient, and we get scenes of Lorraine just gushing over him. You know, this is all of this scenery is making Marty's cause worse, because she's seeing him both standing up to Biff and doing all this sort of acrobatics on a skateboard, and she's isn't he a dreamboat? Gushing.
He a dream? Yeah. And she says at the end of it all, a bit sinisterly, like the kids go, "Who is he? Where does he live?" And she goes, "I don't know, but I'm gonna find out." Like, all right, Lorraine, he's up.
If that was the other way around, that'd be really sinister, wouldn't it? If it was I'm gonna find where she lives.
Get the first occurrence of manure.
Yes, it's an ongoing thing. Is that all three films? I think it happens in.
Yeah. The third one's the kind of least showy, because it's just a cart of manure, isn't it? That Mad Dog falls into. But yeah, this is the first manure related incident for Biff.
But everything here, everything that's happening in this timeline is what, and if I do an episode about the second film, this is all setting up everything that happens in the second film as well. You know, because Biff in the, you know, well, going into it, Biff is angry at Marty because he's cost him, he keeps saying, $300 worth of damage with all the manure and everything. So that increases their beef, which, to be honest, this is kind of the last of their interactions, really. Other than, you know, Biff taking him out of the car when he's trying to do whatever to Lorraine. This is the last time they really have much to do with each other. But when Lorraine follows Marty back to Doc's house, and I mean, there's the really endearing part of Doc when he's talking about the scale model, and he's really apologetic around. He's like, "I'm so sorry. It's awful," and it's just amazing.
I'm sorry, it's not to scale, he says, doesn't he?
I haven't had time to paint it.
Yeah, I love that bit.
And he shows him his whole plan to get the car to strike as the moment the lightning strikes. And it's all very, you know, it's nice. And then the amusing bit where the car catches fire. But then Lorraine turns up, and immediately, you know, Doc sees her and asks,
more great eyeball work. Eyeball work from Doc Brown in the background as he's realizing what's going on between the two. He's like in the background giving it the full stare.
I'm sure someone's done a score, like it's probably a BuzzFeed article about the best eyeball actors in Hollywood, and Christopher Lloyd's got to be up there.
He's got to be up there.
I mean, harking back to was it the pilot of Street Hawk that Christopher Lloyd was in, and I think the end when he's going off the cliff after he's been done by the somersault and he's in his car going off the cliff, and I think that's just all eyeball as well. I mean, he's a lot more menacing than Doc Brown, but yeah, it's the obligatory Street Hawk reference there. Now this, and again after this, because Marty's been invited to the dance by Lorraine, the plan has become now he will fumble with Lorraine in the back of the car, which is must just be weird to talk about, you know, fumbling with your mum.
Talking about it to George, isn't he, in George's garden. And one thing I noticed is that George's laundry hanging on the clothesline is very shambolic. He sort of just puts things up by a single peg, doesn't spread them out. So I was like, George, what are you doing? It's not going to get dry very quickly.
That's like the sort of thing that gets frequently discussed in the Betamax household about washing up. It's never going to dry if you put it like that, bloody hell.
Yeah.
And this is the callback again to Marty using those quotes back at George.
Yes.
You know, saying if you put your mind to it, you can accomplish anything. And it, was it, who was it said that to Marty in the first place? Was it, did he say it was Doc?
Yeah, I think he did, didn't he? Yeah. It's the rejection one. He said he's sounding like his dad, doesn't he? So that came from his dad. But the other one, I think, was Doc Brown. Yeah.
And there's this whole thing now where the plot is Marty will fumble Lorraine, George will turn in and say, hey, you get your damn hands off her. And it, you know, the way they're doing it, it's like, you know, teenagers plotting a dramatic performance in the school play, you know, where in actual fact you're
talking
about.
Line, George.
And is it okay to swear?
Yeah.
You know, it's like you're asking your teacher for permission. I guess this must be the Saturday of the dance now, because they're doing this, hanging the laundry during the day. Doc and Marty are now at the scene of the clock tower doing the what Doc calls the weather experiment, as he's bribing the cop when he asks him about a permit.
Very subtle. Yeah, I didn't really caught that this time around, I think, because I was watching so closely. Because I've always wondered, like, why would he have a permit? And then I saw him opening his wallet, and I was like, oh, wait, I know.
And while this is happening, Marty is writing a letter to Doc warning him of what happens. Because, I mean, Doc's been throughout saying, you know, don't change anything about your future, despite the fact that's all he's done.
He doesn't want to know too much about the future either. But you get that scene where Marty walks, I think it's before the Lorraine arrival scene, where he walks in on Doc watching the VCR on his own, kind of thing. Like, he's gone, skipped ahead a bit further than what Marty had showed him. So, like, there's already kind of, like, hints that he might be willing to peek, if he, you know.
Yeah, because, I mean, I think the way, the time when Marty comes in, and it's almost, I mean, it's a good job he was watching that video and nothing else, when he walks in and catches him, like, oh. And I think it's the bit where, on the video, he's saying, run for it, Marty.
Yeah.
So he obviously, you know, he's at a point when something's gone wrong.
Yeah.
I guess Marty wasn't fully filming when the Libyans shot him. But yeah, so he's writing this letter basically saying, you know, on the night of whatever date, bad things happen. So we go to the dance, and it's Marvin Berry, Marvin. and this is the scene where it is Marty and Lorraine in the car.
Yeah.
And it's all the doing all the things that she had originally said she never did. When Marty was talking about with Jennifer, it's like, I never sat in a parked car or drank or smoked or anything with a boy. Yeah. And, you know, I suppose that's the thing, isn't it? If you're Marty, you must think your mum is this boring, you know, holier than thou person because she's saying that. And yet you go back and see her as she was. You know, she was drinking, smoking in a parked car with a boy she'd met, what, 5-6 days previously.
Yeah. It all comes, I mean, I think that's like the crux of what was the inspiration for part of the film anyway, because I remember Bob Gale saying that he, you know, he found a picture of his dad in a high school book or something, and he just suddenly wondered what it must be like for his dad to be, you know, what was his dad like at that age, kind of thing, because you don't think of them as being once young teenagers having a good time, kind of thing, you know. And that sort of planted the seeds for this. So, and it's, yeah, it definitely comes into effect here.
Yeah, I suppose that must be something. If you're, I guess, and this crosses the generations, if you are a child or you are a parent, then would you get on with that person? Bear in mind how much, you know, people change probably the minute they have kids, but also, you know, I mean, before I had kids, I was probably a lot different than I was at 17, for example. But, there is that conversation where, you know, you do wonder. I mean, you never think about, would my mum fancy me when I was 17? But this is that's a different, whole different conversation. Something you probably have with your therapist. But, you know, there is that kind of clever flip that when Lorraine kisses Marty, because she's on the front foot here, and he, very clever, you know, the way he does it, he kind of really withdraws, and and she says, it's like I'm kissing my brother. And I mean, she got the relationship wrong, but at least there was a family resemblance there.
And it's sort of, it's this point where she sort of gets over her Calvin Klein crush.
I think it's probably lucky Biff came in at that point, because otherwise things would got really weird. There was one bit I actually noticed, this is the first time, when just before the kiss, and I don't know whether this was deliberate or not, but Marty kept looking at her chest, because I mean, she was wearing quite a low cut dress.
I was noticing that this time around.
And it's just a bit like, I know you probably spent a lot of time there as a baby, but still,
eyes up.
I mean,
she's up here, Marty, she's up here.
Eye contact at all times.
Yeah.
Yeah, that's I mean, this is the kind of the weird scene I suppose a lot of films have. Yeah. But you know, when mother kisses son, yeah
a bit weird to say the least. But yeah, like you say, it's quite clever leaving the way it reverses the situation and stuff. And
yeah, because yeah. I mean, she says to him at one point, "You sound like my mother." When yeah. you know, so there are light bits, and it does, you know, despite the fact, I mean, the film's longer than I remember. I mean, I turned it on last night, so it was nearly 2 hours. But it doesn't feel like there's a lot of wasted time.
No, I was thinking that.
You know, that there's that. I mean, there is a tendency now for films to be, or the big films to be, sort of 2.5-3 hours long.
Yeah.
Was this one was just under 2 hours, and it didn't feel like it. It moved quickly, and yeah. you know, I don't know. It there wasn't, you know, if you went back and were forensic about it, is there much that people would cut out? Not really. I don't think any scene is wasted at all.
No, it's all either driving the story forward or exploring the central idea about it all. And there's stuff that's setting up and paying off earlier bits. It all works together, fits together really well, and it all snaps along really well, I think.
And just to bring it back down, we now cut to the I suppose we'll call it the attempted rape.
Yeah.
Biff basically throws Marty out of the car. His goons chuck him in the back of Marvin's car, and I've just written it rapey, because the way Biff gets into the car, we know, and again from context of the second film, that he's had this crush on Lorraine and everything, and he's made, I think he made some comments in there as well about that weren't pleasant anyway. And because George has psyched himself up to basically grab Marty out of the car and fake this fight, and all of a sudden it's like Luke Skywalker against Darth Vader, you know, suddenly yeah. his biggest enemy gets out of this car, and it's like, oh god.
Yeah.
I mean, it's really well done, sort of climactic, I suppose, battle between the two.
Yeah, despite the awfulness around it, it's like the George moment, I mean, he doesn't, even when he's realised it's Biff, he doesn't back away. He sort of persists, which is showing like his gradual development as a character kind of thing. You know, he's willing to still, even though he knows, you know, he's probably in for a hiding, he's like, okay, I'm here, I'm going to persist, I'm going to do it. It's the right thing to do, you know. And yeah, the whole moment where he sort of overcomes Biff, and, you know, you see the fist slowly clenching as he gets angrier and angrier with him. And yeah, it's a great triumphant little moment when he knocks Biff out to the ground, you know.
I think the fact that there is that quote, I can't remember who said it, around, you know, all evil needs is for good men to do nothing. And, you know, George has basically walked in on a bully assaulting a young woman. And, yeah. you know, that you kind of think that for him, the easy thing would be to do is to turn around and walk away.
Yeah, yeah.
Like you say, he stood up to his bully, not yeah. just, you know, for Lorraine's honour or anything, but but that is his character arc. And I think the fact that, you know, we finally see, albeit, you know, the way they've met originally was that George was perving on a woman and got hit by a car. This way he
yeah.
basically fights off his love's rapist.
Yeah.
I suppose they're two very alternative ways of, what was it called, the meet cute, where two characters meet in a film.
Yeah. But
they, you know, they walk away happily ever after, and Biff's been chinned. It's all very yeah. nice. And there's the surprise of the bystanders. Is that George McFly?
Yeah. Yeah. Is that George McFly?
But there's still the element where they're not fully together yet, because Marty's on stage, because Marvin has cut his hand open, and so Marty's on stage standing in for the guitarist, and he's got the photograph of, so his brother's disappeared,
yeah.
his sister has either part disappeared or she's in the process of going, and he's on stage doing the guitar, and while he's playing, the sort of disappearance continues, and because George and Lorraine haven't had that first kiss yet, he's now, and that bit you pointed out earlier where his hand starts going,
yeah, which he starts probably sinking to the floor.
Yeah, and it's, as you say, maybe it is the only slightly, and even then to call it ropey is probably doing it a disservice. It's just not,
yeah,
you know,
yeah, it's not what we do now, yeah,
it's not that bad. And then old Ginger Bollocks comes along and steals Lorraine from him, and
Yeah, I didn't know if that was the same, because I noticed when I was watching it that the guys kicking George when in the school corridor earlier were both redheads as well. Well, two of the three were redheads. I noticed, and I thought, has George done something to like upset the redhead community in the school? What's going on here? Everyone, all the redheads in the school seem to have got a vehement disliking of George McFly.
He'd probably put something on Facebook slagging him off or something.
Probably wrote a story, one of his stories about evil redheads or something.
Invasion of the ginger aliens. And again, they still need this little escalation to get him over the line. You know, he has to push Ginge over for them to have that kiss, and all of a sudden Marty's hand grows back.
It's that great musical cue as well, where the music sort of picks back up again and Marty stands back up again, like fully restored,
all back to normal. And this is and one thing, I mean, first time really mentioning it, the music. I know some people will talk about the music throughout the film, and it was Alan Silvestri did the score. Yeah. It's very, everyone knows the theme to Back to the Future and a lot of the cues throughout. But something I mentioned on a previous episode was that Alan Silvestri also did the musical score for Predator. And it's quite similar.
Yeah, it is in some ways, isn't it? Yeah. It's a hint of,
And of course, we know in here the Predator is Biff. I don't think there's any mention of Get to the Chopper, but I mean, as iconic 80s film scores go, this is one of them, isn't it?
Oh, definitely. Yeah, it's like one of my favourites. Yeah, I own all three soundtracks, soundtracks. Because, I love the music. It's like rousing. For all the set pieces that it needs to be, it's like properly tips the set piece over just that little bit more. The music just pounds along, it's rousing, you're like, yeah, come on, da, da, da. Yeah. You know, it's definitely one of them. It definitely does work beautifully.
Yeah. And of course we've borrowed a couple of songs here, and Johnny B. Goode makes an appearance. Yeah. And this is just a crazy kind of, I suppose it is one of the archetypal kind of, have you ever seen that film? And again, making this a bit more modern, have you seen that film Yesterday that came out
recently? Oh, no, I haven't.
Recently?
No. Is that the Beatle one? Where they're going?
Awful.
Right, yeah.
But the premise in there is that this guy has an accident, wakes up, and no one had ever heard of the Beatles except for him. So he starts singing Beatles songs and passing them off as his own. Now this is the premise of when Marty gets up on stage and plays Johnny B. Goode that no one had ever heard. And causes Marvin to call his cousin Chuck Berry.
Chuck.
Yeah, very convenient.
This is your cousin Marvin. Marvin Berry.
Remember me? And it's, I suppose that's the thing where, you know, Marty regresses back to that loud pinhead music, you know, audition where he gets a bit too carried away on the same stage, kicks things over, and I mean it's weird again when we go to the second film and you see it from a different perspective, you know, this is all still going on, and it's, I mean, that again, it, we'll explore that another time, but that the way they did that was very well, the way they worked around the structure of this film, but no, that was, I mean, I remember watching that just thinking, wow, you know, that's like me going back in time to the early 90s and, I don't know, turning up and doing an Oasis song at my school dance or something.
Yeah. I know it's a point of contention for some people as well. Like, you know, again, it's like that Mayor Goldie Wilson thing. Did Chuck Berry write Johnny B. Goode off of his own back, or did he write it because he heard Marty playing it? And you know what they, you know, that kind of thing again. It's like, are we letting Marty take credit for this song now? Is that what's happening? What's, you know?
And because this is finished, and then Marty says goodbye to Lorraine and George in the stairwell, and this is the bit where she says, "Oh, Marty, interesting name."
Also noticed that George also now has a slightly deeper, more confident voice. You know, like throughout the rest of the film, he's like quite, I don't know, I'm here. And when he sees Marty off, he's like, hey Marty, yeah, nice, great music, you know. He's like, sounds really with it all of a sudden, you know, just like that. He's like lost that nerdy kind of squeaky voice and gone all, I'm a man now.
It's like that scene in Superman when Christopher Reeve takes off his glasses and physically changes as well. Because George has now kissed Lorraine, he's suddenly Billy Big Bollocks and gives her large. She is mine now. But that's when she says, "Oh, Marty, what an interesting name." And that's the bit that always sticks with me, where you kind of think, okay, and do you not call back to that at all when you have a kid?
Does it not trigger anything? Or should we call you Marty like that kid? Marty.
Nothing happened, honest. And we get back to the clock tower because Doc's still setting up the experiment. And this is the peril and the part we talked about earlier where the scene, because the wire that's coming down from the clock tower, he's hanging off the clock. It's, you know, it's really cutting it fine the way he's hanging off. And it's really sort of prescient of that clock you mentioned at the beginning.
Oh, yeah, it's like a really good little finale. It's like a triple wrongness. That's a terrible way of saying it. You know, it's like escalates. So you get like Marty sits in the car won't start. Meanwhile, back at Doc Brown, the ledge falls off and he's hanging. And then he pulls the cable and the cable becomes undetached. And it's like everything going wrong. And you're thinking, how are they all going to do this? And the music's pounding away, you know?
I'm trying to think back to, and I'm sure it was in one of the, maybe it was in a sequel where the ledge not being there was more apparent. And I don't know if it was something they focused on or not, because at the beginning it was, you know, and then the fact that Doc had knocked that bit of ledge off. And I'm sure there was a callback, you know, where you can see. But yeah, it is just this kind of, there is a lot of, again, Sterling eyeball work going on.
There's some good screams as well. From Doc Brown.
And I've just written that the bit where you mentioned that the car conks out, and I said, this really isn't a good advert for DeLoreans. And it, you know, you can start a car by headbutting it. And the bit where, and of course, you know, what we kind of glossed over was the fact that when the clock dies at 10:04 p.m. how did they know exactly that the lightning would strike as soon as the clock changed? Because, you know, the lightning strikes as soon as the clock changes, and then Doc Brown just reconnects the cable as the lightning is coming through, and I guess he must have been wearing sort of safety gloves or something so that he didn't
die. I always thought that. He's got to be. He must have known what he's doing.
The film would have been very different if he died in 1955.
And Marty didn't get back. And all through that scene, the music again is just pounding along. It's dramatic. It's exciting. It just adds to the whole sense of, you know, escalation of, is it going to work? Is it not going to work? It's great.
There is that tension there that's, you know, we've had enough already with the kiss and the rope and all the music and everything. And now we get, you know, because Doc, you know, he plays such a good supporting role in throughout. And this is his kind of moment, really, where his science sort of comes through.
He gets with actions.
It does.
Sliding down the wire.
Slide down like a soldier and all that. And then just sort of the last second, just as Marty drives through and the lightning strike comes through, he manages to connect the cable and that music. Yeah. And then there is that bit at the end when the DeLorean has vanished and he sort of celebrates at the end. It is that kind of redeeming feature for him. All his work worked out through. But what Marty had done is he changed the time so that when he goes back to 1985, he's gone back a little bit earlier. Now, when he lands in 1985, it's still 10 minutes or so early, and the DeLorean conks out again. one thing, and I don't know if this has been confirmed at all, but something I've read previously was that apparently the tramp or the bum, wherever you are, someone was saying that is Red Thomas, who was the mayor in 1955.
And I
don't know how far this kind of theory's gone, but
that's interesting.
And again, it's work, you know, there's a lot of sort of conjecture and everything, but I'm sure I read somewhere that they said it was true and someone else has kind of disproved it, but they were saying that that tramp is the former mayor.
Yeah, I've often wondered if he had like some kind of, yeah, like ancestor in 55 or something, or was, you know, was someone from 1955, because he seems like such a odd character to just pop up, you know. Like, is that someone I should have paid attention to? Is this a callback?
Because his name's, is it Red? And I think, and that was the mayor's name in 55. So, again, someone will probably correct me and tell me definitively, because they know more than I do. They always do. but he goes back to the shopping mall, which is now Lone Pine Mall, and yep. watches the Libyans chasing the... Well, he watches them shoot Doc Brown again, which, again, is really traumatic stuff, you know. And he yeah. sees the chase going on, and they crash into a like a Fujifilm kind of. I've probably got the brand wrong. It's probably Canon or something. They crash into a camera developing little stall.
Yeah, and that's enough to knock him out.
And Marty finds Doc lying there, and again, like, you know, we know now that he's still alive because he's kept the letter and he's got a bulletproof vest on. I mean. He got shot several times with an AK-47.
Yeah.
I mean, I don't know how effective a bulletproof would be. I mean, he's going to suffer, even if it doesn't kill him, he's going to suffer some massive trauma injuries from the bulletproof vest.
Yeah.
And he gets up and is all very chirpy.
Yeah, he's fine. Yeah. Yeah, because there's no specifics mentioned in Marty's letter. They'll be using an AK-47, so make sure, you know, it's like, you'll just be killed, shot and killed by terrorists. So he's got to, yeah.
I mean, what would they have done if they shot him in the head? But then, I think that was the joke in Dumb and Dumber, wasn't it?
But what if he shot you in the face?
What if he shot me in the face?
That's a risk we were willing to take.
And of course he's still got the letter. Now he drops Marty off at the house and goes off, was it 30 years? So he goes off to 2015
yeah.
in the car and all that. And this is the thing I find weird the next morning, because everything's better. Now, George and Lorena are married. They're happy. George is apparently successful because his novel is there. We don't know what they do, but they're still living in the same house.
Yes, except it's a bit more together now, though.
It looks like Lawrence Llewellyn Bowen has done his job there.
Yeah.
Everything. There's lots of candle holders and stuff, and his brother and sister are now looking like kind of really together people rather than the slobs that they were portrayed as earlier. And I always find it weird that Biff brings the books in, and Biff is cleaning George's BMW.
Yeah.
Now, again, we're in this timeline where we're from here. Now, Biff in this timeline tried to rape Lorraine, and George basically keeps Biff around. You know, he's like, "Oh, Biff, what a character!"
It's yeah.
Is it like at the end of Shaun of the Dead where Shaun keeps Nick Frost as a zombie instead? He's like,
yeah, there's that line as well. It was like, if it wasn't for him, we would never have fallen in love.
Yeah, but what was he doing?
it's not a cheery little story. Oh, if it wasn't for him, we would never. Oh. You
know? And they completely forget about Marty.
The
guy who actually engineered it all, who is now your son.
Who's now your son wearing the same clothes.
With the same name.
Yeah.
I always find that weird, and I mean, please, if anyone's listening and taking exception to this, I am not slagging it off. I think it's just one of these things that you can always pick holes in time travel stuff, and it's amusing. And I don't think it's, I mean, the film is no worse for it. It's just an amusing thing. But and then Marty opens the garage, and he's got the truck in there that he lusted after at the beginning of the film. Jennifer turns up, glorious Jennifer. Sight for sore eyes indeed.
How about a ride, mister?
Jennifer. Oh, you a sight for sore eyes. Let me look at you.
Marty, you're acting like you haven't seen me in a week.
I haven't.
You okay? Is everything all right?
Oh, yeah. Everything is great.
And then we have the bit that I guess initially was just, this was always meant to be a standalone film.
I was going to say, there's no sequels planned initially. This was just meant to be a funny little, ha ha, because something's got to be done about your kids. See ya.
Yeah. I mean, I suppose it would work better in the 80s. You know, I mean, now everything's a franchise or something, but this would have been that kind of teaser almost. But, you know, Doc Brown has come back from the future and says something's got to be done about your kids.
I think it's always nice that Doc Brown comes back the next morning because he could time travel, so he could come back as soon as he had left, like the night before. But he gives Marty a night to sleep, rest up. I think that's nice.
he's probably very tired from his adventures there.
Yeah.
And there's this, you know, the whole thing that the DeLorean can fly, and there's that, you know, again, for a line at the end of the film that I guess when it came out doesn't really mean anything. When he says, no, you haven't got enough road to get up to 88, you know, and this wasn't engineered for a sequel, is it? You know, roads, where we're going, we don't need roads.
Yeah.
And that's just, I mean, what a line to end a film on.
It is. It's just a perfect little cap.
Especially when, you know, you don't know, there's no intentions at the time to be a sequel. And this is just the mystery, and it's able to stand on its own two feet.
Yeah, if the other two hadn't followed, it's a nice little place to end and imagine what other adventures they might have gone on to. Oh, then they would have flown off into the future. What would they have found there? But you do get those questions answered. But as a standalone, it would have still worked. So, yeah.
Yeah, and I guess that's the best part of it, is that it works on its own. It works as well with the other two films. And I didn't realise, because I had the film on iTunes and I watched that on there last night, and I think it's the first time I've watched it on there from beginning to end. And I'm so used to that film having the to be continued at the end.
Oh, yeah.
And when I watched it on here, it didn't have it. And I think that's something they've done with the recent re-releases, is they've gone back to the original kind of...
Take it out.
And immediately kind of think, oh, okay, you know, so, and this is what people would have seen in 1985. And I guess, you know, it doesn't make it any better or worse. And I suppose if you've had a sequel greenlit, I mean, even if it was to be continued and it didn't continue, there's your imagination, that thing that people don't use enough these days. But it's, you know, I think this as a film, as a standalone, is almost perfect. I mean I'm not going to sit here and go it's not for this reason. And apparently there was, and again the IMDb trivia said that there are film schools that use this film as the perfect screenplay, the way that the story's constructed and the way the characters develop, and you have no arguments with that at all.
No, I can't, like, yeah, just for, like I was saying about the opening scene, like there's so many good bits throughout, and the whole structure of it as a whole just works so well. It's so tightly written, so characters develop nicely. Yeah, I can see why they use it for that kind of thing.
And, you know, 35 years later, we're still talking about it. It's still a big thing. And, I mean, the time we're recording, it's, again, like I said earlier, is the 3rd of November. You know, we're, a couple of days away from 35 years since the Clock Tower, 65 years.
Yeah.
God, I lose track. You know, it's that time of year where it's the big thing. And it's just, you know, when people talk about seminal 80s films... and we, you know, with this podcast, we're now into the sort of the 80 plus episodes of it, and there's still a few more I haven't done, but, you know, if people go back to their top 80s films, this will almost certainly be in most people's, if not their top 10, then top 5. And it's just absolutely, you know, you can, there's enough in there for people that, I mean, if people watched it now, it would be weird watching something from that far back, because we're now, the time difference is even further away than in the original. But I wouldn't hesitate to show this to anyone and say, watch this and don't enjoy it.
Yeah. I mean, I've shown it to my own kids, you know, and they've enjoyed it, you know, got swept up in it. it's smartly written, it's funny, it's exciting, it's well paced, it's, you know, it's got it all.
And at the time of writing anyway, I mean, Robert Zemeckis and Bob Gale are still with us, and apparently they've sort of on record said there will not be a sequel, there will not be a remake or a reboot.
Yeah.
And I really hope they stick to that, because, I mean, we've seen with, you know, nothing is sacred these days, but, you know, we've seen, you know, how Terminator has gone off a cliff and Indiana Jones was at a ruin, but they added
RoboCop came back.
And... Oh, God, yeah.
It was something
just,
else.
Just leave it alone. Leave it alone. But fingers crossed.
Fingers crossed. We can try some new ideas. How about that, Hollywood?
Yeah.
I don't want to sound like an old grouch, but you know, it's just like when you grow up in the 80s and you think of what came out along there, you know, stuff that's still being recycled and expanded upon now. And you sort of think, I'd just like to see more stuff that comes along and goes blam from nowhere. And you go, where'd that come from? You know? That's what a lot of these were. They were just things that, you know, now are iconic and classic and continually reiterated on. But originally, they just came out of seemingly nowhere. They weren't based on anything else. You know, they were just weird ideas that worked.
Yeah. And there is, I suppose, in whatever studio discussion, I don't go into those too much. I mean, you can get film stories for that. But the way that, you know, this has Spielberg's name on it, which probably gave it enough gravitas to get it made in the first place. I mean, I guess he probably... whether he came across the script or the production or something, but you know, if you know, that's maybe that's what films needed, and these days perhaps these kind of visionary directors could get involved a little bit more and champion those films that might otherwise go a little bit unnoticed. And you know, not everything has to be a multi-billion-dollar franchise or
It's all become franchise. It's sort of flipped, hasn't it? It's come more about the franchise and the characters rather than the people behind them championing these new ideas.
Let's say there's an argument for another time, and we'll let someone else time travel to that time, because I'm happy where I am, thank you very much, Hollywood. Andy, where we're going, we don't need roads, but we do need to find out a little bit more about you and where we can find you, and what more importantly, because as we talked about a little bit, some of the cartoons and the things that you work on are things that are seminal throughout a lot of people's sort of lives themselves. I mean, I grew up with the Beano and grew into Viz, which I'm sure a lot of people did. Now, sort of, again, I've already said Beano and Viz, but where else can people find you?
I'm currently writing for the Beano, so I'm writing Me, the Minx, the Bastard Kids every week, near enough. But you can find me on the internet, on Twitter at YourPalFanton. I've got a website called Fanton's Things with a F for alliteration purposes. That's not the whole address, not all of it, what I just said, just the Fanton's Things bit. That's pretty much the two main avenues that you can find me at.
Lovely. And I'll get plenty of links to those in the show notes. And as we discussed off air, now the film came out in the UK on the 4th of December 1985. Now I guess by the time this comes out, the previous episode will have been The Goonies, which, and I didn't even touch on that, there is a rumor doing the rounds that these were actually set on the same day, that The Goonies Adventure was on October the 26th 1985, as was the main sequence of the 1985 part of this. So if that's the case, bloody hell, why is that not a bigger thing? But because of that, the number one song in the UK when this came out was also I'm Your Man by Wham. But because this film has a song that goes with it that is awesome, and it's Huey Lewis in the News. So let's play that one instead. That'll be a lot more fun. So, Andy, thank you very much.
Thank you very much.
I need a nuclear reaction to generate the 1.21 gigawatts of electricity. 1.21
gigawatts! 1.21 gigawatts! Great Scott!
This podcast was brought to you by executive producers Keith Foster, Jimmy Fletcher, Mark Drakes, Matt Cunnington, Christian Dees, Chris Hopkins, Omar Zambon, Ian Madrell, Catherine Lowe, Mark Makin, Zoltan Vargo, Simon Smith, Laurie Curran, Wayne McNally, Darren Hodgkins, Dan Wellington, Alex Heal, Philip Rothenberger, Alan Fewings, Tom Carr, James Kennedy, Simon Pegg, Joe Harrison, Anita Singh and Jason Clarkson, and associate producer Chris Oakley. Visit patreon.com/Betamax Video Club for more information about bonus episodes, early access, discounted merchandise, and more.